for being so grief-stricken over the loss of his son, Absalom. He tells him that instead of being like that, he needs to go out to the people that put their lives on the line and let them know how much he appreciates what they did. And I talked a little bit about how Joab was just a hypocrite because he just murdered the king's son, and yet he has the audacity to come in and jump all over David and rebuke him for something that maybe he wasn't handling in the appropriate way. But to David's credit, David responded, and that's something else I mentioned. David was a man that could handle a rebuke. He could take it, and generally he responded in the right way, and he took Joab's advice. But then we saw in verse number 9 where it says that the people were at a strife throughout all the tribes of Israel. And they were saying, the king saved us out of the hand of our enemies, and he delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled out of the land for Absalom. And Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now, therefore, why speak ye not a word of bringing the king back? They're kind of fussing and bickering amongst themselves, saying, look, you know, David did all this stuff for us, but he fled for Absalom, and we anointed Absalom. Now Absalom's dead, so we need to try to bring David back. We need to get him back to be our king. But they're kind of fussing about it. These are the tribes of Israel. But you see in verse number 11, when we pick up today, that King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priest. Those were the two priests, if you remember, that when this whole thing with Absalom started, David told to stay there in Jerusalem. He wanted them to kind of be his eyes and ears, to keep up with all that was going on with Absalom, just to give him a heads up. So he sends to them because they're back in Jerusalem. Remember, David's not in Jerusalem now. He had to flee because of Absalom, or he chose to flee, and he still hasn't returned. So he sends back word to Zadok and Abiathar, saying, speak unto the elders of Judah, saying, why are ye the last to bring the king back to his house, seeing the speech of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house? What it means there at the end of verse 11 is that word had got to David about how Israel was discussing the need to bring David back. He had heard about that. And so he sends to Judah and wants to know, well, hey, what's y'all's problem? Why haven't y'all stepped up? Why are y'all the last? He's implying that they should have been the first. Before Israel, Judah should have stepped up first and said, hey, we need to bring our king back. So he's wondering, what's the deal with them? What's going on? Why they are the last, as he says there in verse 11. He goes on in verse 12 to say, ye are my brethren. You are my bones and my flesh. Wherefore then are ye the last to bring back the king? They were literally his relatives. He was related to them, and that's what he's appealing to here when he says, ye are my brethren, ye are my bones and my flesh. David was from Bethlehem. Bethlehem was in Judah. So David is related to these people, and he's saying, look, we're related here. You shouldn't be the last. You should be the first to step up and want to bring me back. Verse 13, and say ye to Amasa, art thou not of my bone and of my flesh? God do so to me, and more also, if thou be not captain of the host before me continually in the room of David. Now here, verse 13, is kind of interesting to me. He mentions specifically this fellow named Amasa, and he says, you are of my bone and of my flesh. He was a nephew of David. If you look at 1 Chronicles, hold your place right here and go over to 1 Chronicles. 1 and 2 Chronicles are a couple of books in the Bible that often get ignored. 1 Chronicles chapter 2. While you're turning there, you remember this fella, Amasa, you remember when Absalom wanted to make him a leader over his followers, his soldiers? This is the fella he picked out. Y'all remember that? He picked out Amasa and put him over his soldiers. And now David is saying, look, you're my relative, and I'm going to puts you in the position that Joab is in. And Joab was David's main military leader. And he's saying, I'm gonna put you in his place. Now, I don't know if he meant I'm fixing to roust Joab out and I'm going to give you his job, or if he's saying later on when Joab's out of the picture or whatever happens, then you're going to get his position. But either way, he's saying, look, you got some job security here. I'm going to put you in the place of Joab. And why he specifically mentions him and picked him, I don't know, other than the fact that he was family. Maybe that's what it was. It was his nephew. But 1 Chronicles chapter 2, verse number 13, 1 Chronicles 2:13, and Jesse begat his firstborn Eliab, and Abinadab the second, and Shema the third, Nethaneel the fourth, Radai the fifth, Ozam the sixth, and David the seventh. Remember, Jesse was David's dad, and David's the seventh. Verse 16, whose sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail. And the sons of Zeruiah, Abishai, and Joab, and Asahel, three. And Abigail bare Amasa. You see that? So David's sister, Abigail, has Amasa. So this fella here is David's nephew. He's one of his relatives. And maybe that's the reason why he picks him and says, I'm going to give you Joab's position. But as you see from that passage also, Joab was a relative of David as well. But anyhow, back in 2 Samuel 19, it says in verse 14, and he bowed, talking about David, he bowed the heart of all the men of Judah, even as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word unto the king, return thou and all thy servants. It says he bowed the heart. It's kind of like what he said to them humbled them. It sort of embarrassed them, you might say. And all of them as one person, their heart was bowed because they had not been the first to step up and say, we need to bring David back. So they then send word. And the thing about this here is David is still the king, okay? Absalom, you know, he came along, had his little rebellion or whatever, but that thing's been snuffed out, and David technically never was dethroned, okay? He's still the king. He could have just went back, right? I mean, once Absalom's out of the picture, he could have just told his servants, hey, we're going back home. And he really didn't have to ask anybody's permission. He was the king. He didn't have to say, do y'all want me back or anything. He could have just rode back into town and took back over just like he had never left. But he didn't do that. He didn't do that. He waited until he was summoned by the men of Judah before he ever came. And one thing to me that stands out, just a kind of a picture there, is the way the Lord is with people, especially in regards to salvation. The Lord wants everybody to be saved, amen? He don't want anybody to go to hell. He died for the whole world, the sins of the whole world, and he doesn't want anybody to go to hell. But here's the thing. He's not going to save anyone against their will. You hear what I mean? He will save anybody, but he's not going to save anyone that doesn't ask him for salvation. He'll stand at the door and knock, but he's not going to kick the door in. He wants everybody to be saved, but he's not going to save anyone unless they invite him or ask him for salvation. And that's kind of the thing with David here. Hey, he was a king. Jesus Christ, a king, amen? And he can do whatever he wants to do and doesn't have to have my permission or your permission or anybody else's. But the thing is, he's not going to act against our will. It's just something where God chooses to allow us to exercise our free will. And until a person of their own free will asks for salvation, they will not be saved. He's not going to force himself on anybody. And I believe the same is true even in our lives as Christians. Once we do get saved, I still believe even then that the Lord is not going to force himself upon us. Once we get saved, he wants us to love him, to serve him, to be faithful to him, to make him the priority in our lives, to always seek his will and do what we know to be his will. That's what he wants from all of us. But he's not going to force any one of his people to do his will. He's not going to do that. If you don't want to do his will, he'll just let you not do his will. That's what he'll do. He's not going to force himself on you. Again, he'll just stand there and he'll knock. And he'll wait on you. But he's not going to force himself on you. David didn't force himself back. He could have, but he didn't. He waits until he's summoned to come back. And then he goes. Verse 15, so the king returned and came to Jordan. That's the Jordan River. And Judah came to Gilgal to go meet the king, to conduct the king over Jordan. Now, as we proceed on, you're going to see these different people that show up there when they find out that the king's coming back. Some of them come, I believe, for selfish purposes. Some come because they're afraid, they're fearful. There's different people that show up. And as I mentioned on Wednesday night, as you go on through the chapter, you see some beautiful examples of forgiveness and mercy demonstrated by David, which again pictures the way the Lord is with us in our lives. But in verse 16, you meet this first individual who comes. It says, and Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, which was of Bahurim, hasted and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. So Judah comes, and this fella right here, it says, hasted and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. He gets in a hurry about it, and he's making sure he's one of the first ones to show up there to conduct the king back over. Why do you think he wants to be there first? What's the big deal with this fella? Well, hold your place right here and go back just a couple of chapters to chapter 16. Second Samuel chapter 16. After David left Jerusalem when Absalom was doing his thing, he's traveling along and he comes to this place called Bahurim, or Bahurim, ever how you say it. And as he's coming, he's getting close. Look at verse 5, chapter 16, verse 5. And when King David came to Bahurim, behold, thence came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came forth and cursed still as he came. Y'all remember that fellow when we studied about him? When he's coming along, David and his followers are getting close to this place. And this fellow who was of the family of the house of Saul, he was a relative of Saul. Y'all know how all that thing played out between Saul and David. But he comes out and he cursed still as he came. And verse 6 says he cast stones at David and all the servants of King David. As you read on, he says, look, the reason why all this stuff's happening to you is because of what you did with Saul. He accuses David of mistreating Saul, and he says, all that's coming back on you now through your son Absalom, which that was not the case at all, but that's the accusation he makes. And as David's traveling on, this fella just keeps cussing and throwing rocks. You look down at verse 13, and as David and his men went by the way, Shimei went along on the hillside over against him and cursed as he went and threw stones at him and cast dust. Every time I read that, that's funny to me, just that picture of that fella doing that. But anyway, that's how he treated David not too long ago. Well, Absalom's dead now. He's out of the picture, and the king's coming home. Why do you reckon old Shimei wanted to be one of the first ones to go down and greet David on his way back? He's afraid, he's scared, and he's hoping and praying that the king's going to show him some mercy and not remember what he had done earlier on. To me, I don't feel like Shimei's legit in this when he comes and, you know, says what he does to David. I don't think he's genuinely sorry for how he treated David in the past. I really don't. I believe he's scared to death is what I think. He is afraid of the consequences of his actions. I don't think he really is sorry for how he treated David. I think he realizes, hey, I messed up here, and my life is on the line. And that's kind of how it is a lot of times with people. And we'll talk about that more as we go on. But anyway, he comes down first, or he comes down with Judah, and really is the first, I guess you could say, that greets David. But verse 17 says, and there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him. Remember, Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. And since he's a relative of Saul, he's going to be a Benjamite himself. And there's 1,000 men of Benjamin with him. I think he probably brought those 1,000 men not to show some kind of power or try to intimidate David. I don't think it's that at all. I think he brought them kind of as a gift, so to speak. Like, hey, David sees I got 1,000 men that's on my side. If I'm on his side, then David would think I got an extra 1,000 men with me, just sort of trying to finagle his way back into favor with David is the idea. But he brings 1,000 men with him, and then you see verse 17, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him, and they went over Jordan before the king. Y'all remember Ziba? He was the servant of Saul that David put in charge of Mephibosheth. Y'all remember Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son that was lame on his feet? He put him in charge of Mephibosheth. And if you remember, when David brought Mephibosheth to Jerusalem and brought him into his family and told him he could sit at his table and eat and he'd take care of him and so forth, he said that Ziba was responsible to take care of the land, and he could live there, him and his sons and his servants, but they had to take care of Mephibosheth and bring in the food and all that, just make sure Mephibosheth was taken care of. But y'all remember what he did just not too many lessons back when all this stuff started unfolding with David? Remember what happened there? Well, we'll read about that, talk about that a little further on down. But anyway, verse 18 says, and there went over a ferry boat to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. So a boat goes over to transport David and his family back across the Jordan. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was come over Jordan, and said unto the king, let not my lord impute iniquity unto me, neither do thou remember that which thy servant did perversely the day that my lord the king went out of Jerusalem, that the king should take it to his heart. He falls down before him. He says, let not my lord impute iniquity unto me. He calls what he did iniquity, and it was, no question about it. Then he says, neither do thou remember that which thy servant did perversely. He says, what I did was perverse. It was iniquity. It was perverse. He's saying all the right things. And he's asking, really, what he's asking for is mercy. Don't remember this. Don't impute what I did. Just don't take it to heart. He's saying, man, I messed up here. And I wasn't acting right, wasn't thinking right, so please don't hold that against me. Verse 20. He says this, for thy servant doth know that I have sinned. He says that. I know I've sinned. Here's the problem I have with that. If he knew that what he had did was wrong, why would he wait to now to say it? You understand what I'm saying? He didn't have to wait till he hears that David's coming back to come out and admit that he did wrong. As we've gone through this story here, there were people constantly coming to where David was at. Y'all remember that? People would show up and they'd bring him stuff and try to help him out. There were constantly people coming to where David was and showing their allegiance and their faithfulness to him. So had this fella really believed that he had done wrong and had sinned in what he had said to David, he could have, before now, left where he was and came out to where David was at and said, look, I messed up big time. I'm sorry. Please forgive me for what I did. He did not do that. He waits until Absalom is dead and he finds out that David's coming back before he goes out to meet him. That's why I say he's not legit in this. I don't think he really believed he sinned and did wrong. I think he's sorry because he knows he's in trouble. That's what I believe. And I believe that's how it is oftentimes with people. The The Bible talks in the New Testament about godly sorrow versus worldly sorrow. Godly sorrow basically is when you're sorry that you have sinned against God. That's what you're sorry for. You truly, genuinely are sorry that you have sinned against the Lord. Godly sorrow is not being sorry you got caught. That's why a lot of people are sorry. They do things that are terrible, and they get caught, and then they act remorseful. And many times, it's not that they really feel bad about what they've done. They just feel bad they got caught. And now they know they got to deal with the consequences of their actions. It's not a godly sorrow. It's a worldly sorrow. It's a self-centered sorrow is what it is. It's looking out for me. Hey, I'm in trouble. I messed up. Now I'm going to answer for it. And that's how it is with a lot of people. They do wrong, and they get caught, and they seem remorseful, but they're not sorry they've sinned against God. They're sorry because they're in trouble. They're sorry that they got caught doing what they did. And I feel like that's what's going on here with Shimei. I think he's just, hey, I messed up. I'm fixing to wind up in a lot of trouble, so I'm going to go down here and I'm going to say all the right things. Some people have a knack for saying all the right things and to convince people that they're genuine, to make you think that they're legit and they're real, that their motive is right, when in reality that's not the case at all. They're just looking out for self. That's what it is. So he comes and he says all this. He says, verse 20, "For thy servant doth know that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I am come the first this day of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king." He says, hey, to prove that I'm wrong, I'm the first one to show up down here. First one. Well, that sounds good. But again, why did he wait till now? He could have went at any other time. He didn't have to wait till now. If you feel so bad about it, you should have got up a long time ago and went to David and said you were sorry for what you did. He didn't. He waits until he realizes he's in trouble, and that's when he goes. But anyhow, verse number 21, "But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" Now, this is Joab's brother, okay, and this fella has showed up before. Remember when Shimei is doing all that cussing and throwing the rocks and kicking up dust and all that? Y'all remember what Abishai said then? What did he say then? Basically the same thing he says right here. Let me go over and take that fella's head off. Y'all remember that? If you just let me, I'll go cut his head off and I'll put an end to all this. And when he said that back then, how did David respond? He wouldn't let him, right? He kind of rebuked him for what he said there. He said, basically, you sons of Zeruiah, y'all just causing me trouble all the time. Just having to deal with something y'all got going on all the time, is what he says. And he wouldn't let him go. Well, evidently, Abishai didn't learn, because here comes this fella back. And once again, he speaks up and says to David, this fella, he ought to die. He needs to die for what he did. And notice once again, David's response. And David said, "What have I to do with you, ye sons of Zeruiah?" Same exact thing he said before. "That ye should this day be adversaries unto me." He says, you're acting like my enemies in the way you're acting here. "Shall there any man be put to death this day in Israel?" David's thinking, this is a cause for celebration that I'm getting to come back home. This is not a time when people need to be dying. We don't need to have a killing today. We need to have a joyous time, a good celebration, a time of happiness. And then he says, "For do not I know that I am this day king over Israel?" David's like, I don't have anything to prove. I know I'm the king. I don't have to put some man to death to prove who I am. You know, I don't have to do that. The thing is, if you know who you are, you don't have to go around proving it all the time. If you know who you are in Christ, you don't have to go around trying to prove that to other people. You're content in that knowledge. You know, irregardless of what anybody thinks about you, you know who you are because of what the Bible says about you. You don't have to try to flaunt your power or show who you are. David knew he didn't have anything to prove. But here's something interesting. I want you to look over at chapter 17, or look back at chapter 17 with me. You had Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. They were brothers. Y'all remember all three of those dudes. Whenever David talks about them, he always calls them the sons of Zurai. Have y'all noticed that? Most of the time in the Bible, when somebody is called by the name of another person, it's the daddy. You know what I mean? Like, you're the son of such and such, and it'll be that person's daddy. Every time that David refers to them three fellas, he says they're the sons of Zurai. And this is something that I noticed when I was coming through here that I thought was interesting anyway. Chapter 17, verse 25. And Absalom made Amasa captain of the host instead of Joab, which Amasa was a man's son, whose name was Ithra, an Israelite, that went in to Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister to Zeruiah, Joab's mother. You see that? Did y'all follow that right there? Who that Zeruiah is? Joab's mother. Well, if Zeruiah is Joab's mother, then that's Asahel's mother too, and Abishai's mother, because they're brothers, right? So every time that David references them three dudes, he doesn't call them after their daddy's name. He calls them after their mama's name. Why you reckon he'd do that? Some of you theologians in here, help me out. Most of the time it was after the daddy's name, but not here. Every time he says, you sons of Zurai, you sons of Zurai, referencing their mother. Now, you could take a positive spin on it and say, well, maybe their daddy's eyed the picture. In my mind, I don't know if this was a case or not. I know there's something to it, but in my mind, I'm wondering if maybe she wasn't that good of a woman. Same mother, different dad. Could be that. But it could be that she was a bad woman. Because here's the thing about it. Every time he says, ye sons of Zurai, is it in a positive or a negative light? It's always negative, ain't it? Every time he calls them the sons of Zurai, he's getting on to them for something that they ought not be doing. Some attitude they had they didn't need to have, some action they wanted to do, or something they did that they should not have done. Every time he says, you sons of Zurai, I have to put up with y'all all the time. It's almost like, hey, you just acting like your mama. You know, so maybe it's that their mama just wasn't a very good person. I don't know. I know that's hard for some people to believe, that you could actually have a woman that wasn't a good woman. But not every woman's a good woman. Now, there's a lot of wonderful women in this world, a lot of wonderful women in this church right here. But not every woman in this world's a good woman. Not every man is a good man. Right? There's some sorry men, but I don't know, this mindset we've got today, and I think it's just the garbage we get pumped in our head through the liberals and news media and all that, is that all women are good and all men are devils. And I'm not saying this because I'm a man, it's just a fact of life. Not every man's a good man, and not every woman's a good woman. There's some sorry men, and there's some low-down, good-for-nothing women in this world, too. You understand that? That's reality. I mean, if we're going to call it how it is, let's call it how it is. These bad women, these bad men. And I just kind of think that maybe Zurai wasn't a very good woman. Because every time that David says something to them boys and calls them the sons of Zurai, it's in a negative light, implying to me that maybe she wasn't a very positive person. Maybe she wasn't a good influence on her children. We're going to have to stop here for time. Any questions about what we looked at here today? Any questions? All right, we'll take a break.